Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, an old Roman shares seminary experience. A musical meditation focusing on the presentation in the temple. And our popular Latin lover speaks to us of the Romans and their Julian calendar. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. Last weekend, as part of celebrations for the 650th anniversary of the founding of an English and Welsh hospice on the very site where the venerable English College has stood as a seminary since 1579, an invitation to attend the event was extended to the old Romans. That's to say, a group of former alumni, all of whom have lived under the same roof as the current 45-strong group of students, among whom seven priests who inhabit this building in the heart of Rome today. One of these old Romans is Monsignor Peter Fleetwood. I caught up with him earlier in the week and persuaded him to sit down with me for a chat in our studios here, surrounding his early days at the venerable English College. Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, you're one of the old Romans at the venerable English College. Is that what you're called?
I don't feel very old, but I am a former student. Yes, that's what we are called.
How old were you when you first got there?
I was only 17, because in my school there was a tradition of pushing a small group of people through exams a year early. So I did both sets of exams a year early and consequently was a bit younger than most people would be when they go to seminary nowadays, for example.
What happens when you arrive in a seminary? The Venerable English College is a very special seminary in the sense that it has 650 years of history. And first it was a hospice and then 2 centuries later it became a seminary. But the presence of the relics of the martyrs there kind of identifies the college in a certain way, doesn't it?
Well, your original question is quite a difficult one to answer. What happens when you first come? It's very different now because there's been a lot of work put into acclimatizing people to seminaries. But the big difference between when I started and now is that when I started, most of us were brought up in a very strong Catholic culture, you might say. And we didn't need a lot of the extra preparation that students nowadays often do because they come from another world. Some of them haven't been Catholics very long. Most of us were cradle Catholics. Some of them have been away from the church and have come back or have done jobs. Most of us were from school and had never allowed ourselves the luxury of a crisis of faith. So we hadn't stopped going to Mass or anything. We were very boring compared to today's seminarians. So there's quite a programme now. When I came to Rome, we had 2 weeks of occasional Italian lessons from the very old rector, and we were just left to it, basically. You just had to get used to listening to lectures about complicated things like metaphysics in Italian, and hopefully pick up enough Italian to understand it before the exams came along. It was very haphazard. Now it's much, much more worked out. There are programmes of preparation.
More streamlined.
It's much more helpful. You had to help yourself, really, when I started. I don't mind. What I did was go around listening to Italian speaking in the street and missed a few lectures in doing that, of course, and gradually got very, very interested in the studies as well.
So to answer my second question, the presence of the relics of the martyrs, was that meaningful to you in those days?
It was. One of the things I notice as a parish priest now is if I talk about martyrs in general, or if I talk about the Lancashire martyrs, which refers to the part of the country where I'm based and have grown up, most young people haven't a clue what I'm talking about. But when I came to Rome, it was phenomenally meaningful to me that some of the men whose names I'd heard at home had been students in the place where I was to stay for so much of my life. I didn't know then how long I would be staying, but I didn't know, for example, that I'd come back to Rome twice for long periods. But right at the beginning, it was very important and a great privilege, really, to be able to become close to them, looking round and seeing the buildings they saw, in learning about some of the things they used to do and some of the traditions we carried on, even. And the English College has worked hard on keeping that tradition alive. The 1st of December every year is kept as the College Feast. It's the day on which Ralph Sherwin and several others were executed at Tyburn in London. That's always like a big occasion. And at the end of the day, everyone who's there is invited to go into the chapel and stand in front of what's called the Martyr's Picture, a very special picture of the Trinity, based on England and Wales as well, being at the centre of the place where Christ's blood falls on the earth. And in front of that picture, we would sing the great hymn of praise, the Te Deum. That goes back to the days when people were being captured and executed very frequently. As soon as news came back, the students still in the college, everybody would gather, as we do still once a year, and they would sing the Te Deum, the song of praise to God, because of the privilege of one of their number giving his life as a sign that he wouldn't give up his faith.
Who are these Lancashire martyrs? Just to name a few.
There's all sorts of them. One that's from the English College is Robert Haydock. I said Haycock because, in fact, his name is misspelt like that on a plaque in the college. I don't know how they got away with that, putting somebody's name wrong. But Haydock is a village where there's a race course very close to the M6 motorway and the East Lancashire Road. Everybody knows that road junction who's been to the north of England. That's his home country. There's lots of Lancashire names in the list of the martyrs. Many of them didn't, however, study in the English college. They would study in Douai or Reims or other places, but they, and many were lay people, of course. They weren't all priests, but 44 of the students of the English college were martyred, as far as I know.
Tell me, when you were a student, did you have an Anglican presence among the seminarians there?
We did. It started with two people who've become quite prominent in the Anglican Church. That was Nicholas Zagowski and Robert Atwell. Nicholas is a great academic and has done a great service to the Anglican Church and also to ecumenism. Was even an outside examiner at the college at which I taught in Durham. And he's been involved with the Focolare movement, which sounds Catholic but is in fact very ecumenical. Robert Atwell is now the Bishop of Stockport. So it's very nice just to think that some of the people who are influential in the Church of England enjoyed a time with us in the English College, and we certainly enjoyed having them there. It made me think much more than I otherwise would have done about the divisions that we endure, really, and about the need to make some progress. But it also taught us a certain amount of patience with ecumenical change, because there was only one rule. And that rule was no intercommunion. It might have been easier for some people, from some people's perspective, just to say, oh yes, well, let them go to communion. But what it actually did was make us all think a lot more. It was painful. There were tears sometimes for some people at the fact that at the most precious moment of the Mass we could not share communion. But I really am convinced that that made us think. It made us realise it is an important moment, it's an important goal, but we are not the people who should rush that. And then when we did talk, we always had to admit, yes, we do have divisions. We do sometimes believe different things, and there are sometimes divisions for other reasons which have grown through history. But we were taught that patience by that one simple but very difficult rule.
It's a rule that people are often mystified by when they're not informed, I think. What is the exact reason why we don't share communion?
Well, one reason is that the word communion refers to a very deep level of union between people. It's about a sharing of life at a very deep level. And if there are ways, any ways, that you exclude other people from your life, you're not in full communion with them. And we Christians, by belonging to different denominations, we do exclude other people. If they decide to remain in their denomination, we can't tell them that they belong to us. And if we are outside, it's very nice and pleasant to be invited to join in communion. But if I went to communion in another Christian church, I would feel I was telling a lie, because I'm not that close yet, for various reasons, some of which are theological, some of which are social, and some of which are just custom. There's many levels at which we're still divided, and it would be a lie for me to receive communion, to make that sign, because it's not just a sign of me being close to Jesus Christ. It's a sign of me being part of that believing group, and I'm not. And they're not part of mine yet. I'm not saying that's the way it should be or should always be, but it's the way it is at the moment. When we have ceremonies in my church at home, when I know there are a lot of people present who either have not gone to communion for years or are not Catholics, I always say this: at present, we're not yet far enough along the road to unity for me to be able to invite everybody to communion. That's the way things are. You are very welcome to receive a blessing. And of course, you're more than welcome to be here. But I'm not allowed to step beyond the boundaries of the law at the moment. And usually people accept that, and they not only accept it, they come and say, thank you for saying that. Thank you for explaining it. Thank you for thinking of us and still making us welcome. And I think that's the least we can do. And maybe other people have better ways of doing it. But that's just my little way of trying to say to people, I'm sorry, I cannot. I'm not allowed to invite you. But obviously you're very much part of our worship here this morning. It's also the case that many Catholics can't go to communion for various reasons. And I respect them enormously. Some don't respect those regulations. Okay, that's their choice. But the ones who do respect the regulations and will watch everybody else going to communion and say, I'm not allowed, I may come for a blessing or may just sit quietly, I have enormous respect for their integrity. And I sometimes even say that in homilies or in the newsletter or at a moment when I know it's not going to draw attention to a particular person or a particular group. It's very important to recognise that some people don't go to communion. Some people feel they can't because of their marriage situation or something similar. So it's not just excluding non-Catholics, that awful phrase that we use. It's a case of recognising who is not yet allowed to receive communion and also respecting people who understand that they're not, for whatever reason, in a fit state to receive communion, and they make that decision. They admit it, they say, I can't go.
Getting back to the celebrations at the college, you mentioned a moment ago the importance of having an English outpost, an English Catholic outpost close to the Holy See. Do you think that's why the Venerable English College is still valid for English and Welsh seminarians today?
Well, I may be the wrong person to ask, because of course I'm an institution person. I worked in the Vatican for a number of years. I have no problem with all that, but there's a lot of people who find the influence of Rome in their local church life difficult to understand and sometimes hard to accept. So it's good, really, that we have the link, a solid link there, so that some people, at least, will understand what's going on in the links between Rome and the provinces, if you like, of the church, and will know that the link is meant to be a two-way link, that many things come from the ordinary churches to the centre in Rome, as well as instructions and documents and whatever going from Rome to the outlying parts of the church too. It's very much a two-way process. I'm just glad that there's always a presence there to keep the communication alive in a way that's not just a diplomatic way. It's a very ordinary style of communication.
Thank you.
and warm thanks there go to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, who is currently parish priest at St Joseph's, Blundell Sands, in the Liverpool Archdiocese in England. And now I'd like to continue on a musical note with a meditation on the fourth joyful mystery of the Rosary, which focuses on the presentation in the temple. That's with Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
Mary and Joseph came to the temple to present the child Jesus to the Lord, as the law required. The presentation in the temple is the fourth joyful mystery of the Rosary. We celebrate it liturgically 40 days after Christmas, on the Feast of Candlemas, when we process with lighted candles, bearing witness before the world to the light of Christ. In fact, Simeon describes Jesus as Lumen ad Revelationem Gentium, a light to enlighten the Gentiles.
Lumen ad Revelationem Gentium, et gloriam plebis tuae Israel.
For our musical meditation today, I'd like to focus on the figure of Simeon. He is presented to us as an old man, devout and upright, faithful to the traditions of Israel. He's one of those pivotal figures between the Old and New Testaments. For most of his life, he was waiting for the Messiah to come, but at the end of his life, he had the privilege of seeing for himself the one who would bring salvation to his people. Senex puerum portabat, the old man carried the child, yet the child was the old man's king. The setting of the Magnificat Antiphon for First Vespers on the Feast of the Presentation was composed by William Byrd, a Catholic composer in the reign of Elizabeth I. It's included in a large collection of music that he wrote for use in Catholic worship behind closed doors in the homes of the aristocracy, because Catholic worship in England at that time was strictly against the law of the land. William Byrd enjoyed special favour with Queen Elizabeth, who knew a good composer when she heard one. Although he was a Catholic, he was employed to write music for the Chapel Royal for much of his life. Not only did the Queen apparently not mind him being a Catholic, but there is evidence that she privately paid him an allowance to help him meet the cost of the fines he incurred as a result. He returned the compliment by composing the most glorious music for the liturgy of the Chapel Royal. Listening to the Nunc Dimittis from Byrd's Great Service. Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace according to thy word. This is the third of the great gospel canticles that form part of the daily liturgy of the hours, and St. Luke places it on the lips of Simeon during the scene of the presentation of the Lord in the temple. It's a marvelous prayer. Simeon acknowledges the privilege he has been given, and he speaks prophetically of the light that Jesus will bring to all the nations of the world. I'd like to finish with a more modern setting of the Nunc Dimittis. It was written by Gustav Holst for the choir of Westminster Cathedral in 1915. Listen to the energy of those repeated phrases, Lumen ad Revelationem Gentium, and the exaltation of the concluding Et Gloriam Plebis Tue Israel. With joy let us contemplate the infant Jesus, who is indeed the light to enlighten the Gentiles, and the glory of his people Israel.
And a big thank you this time to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. Finally, on a more quirky note, time to join our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who worked most of his life as papal Latinist and who's now teaching in the United States. Teaching Latin, of course. Why don't you stay tuned as I tackle with him a conversation surrounding the Romans and their Julian calendar. Why don't we begin today by putting the expression that goes Veni, Vidi, Vici into its Latin context, right? Mm. Somehow I think it's linked to the Julian calendar.
No, not the Julian calendar. It's a link to Julius Caesar, period. It has nothing to do with the calendar.
But why? Maybe because July is...
No, okay. That's a whole... Before you get things mixed up. Okay, fine. The expression came... Because after the Civil War, when he finished off Pompeius Magnus, he went down and all, and he went down to Egypt, Cleopatra, and he came swinging up to, like, say, Turkey today. And one of the towns he took in, like, 10 minutes, called Zela, in the middle of modern-day Turkey, Zela, Z-E-L-A. And he more or less, in a certain one, he announced his victory over this town by, like, a telegram affair, saying, I came, I saw, I conquered. That's Veni, Vidi, Vici, or Veni, Vidi, Vici. Got the idea? So the words are of Julius Caesar. Now, talking about the calendar bit is something else. But the fact is that, oh, no one knows this whole story at all. But the fact is, even in Caesar's time, no, Caesar was killed now in 44. But Cicero had, the months were being changed because it should have been, Quintilis, it's the fifth month. And so they said, instead of calling it the fifth month, just by numbers, we're going to call it Julius, you see.
July.
Julius, Mensa Julius, you see. Then, instead of the sixth month, Sextilis, we'll call this after the Emperor Augustus, and that's Augustus. And then they went back to the numbers. September is the seventh month. Now, what a lot of people don't know, and maybe your listeners are thinking of this, September is the ninth month, but septem in Latin means seven. Ever think of that? Why? For the simple reason that until about 190, when did they change the calendar? For the Romans, the year began in March. Now, if you start into March, you start March, well, then the month we're in right now as we're talking is the seventh month. Got it? And December is the 10th month.
And October is the eighth
month, well, certainly. Then, of course, this went on for centuries. And January is the 11th month, and February is the 12th month. And this went on until the Romans, and even today in most governments, they start their fiscal year, you know, taxes and stuff, with the 1st of March. Because that's how the Romans, the calendar began, the 1st of March. Anyway, that's how you get this whole story, that we're in the ninth month, but we call it the seventh month, because we're still following this old Roman thing. The Romans themselves changed it. But after about 500 years of Roman history, they changed it.
So it was to do with the Roman numerals rather than...
It's all Roman numerals.
Rather than...
And the idea that they started their year with March, that gets December, Christmas time, the 10th month. A lot of people don't know this other one story. Janus, of course, is the god of the two doors. They realized that the year was coming around and starting up again. After the 21st of December, we start, you know, kind. So Janus was looking behind the old year and the new year. Janus is Januarius, January. Janus had two heads looking ahead, went back, you know, backwards. And the Catholics should remember, the old Catholics, now the young ones don't know anything either, anyway. But, don't tell me. But the fact is, February, in Latin, in your Latin dictionary, februo means to purify.
And in the old liturgy, February the 2nd was the day we celebrated the Feast of the Purification, no?
Which is not anymore. But for the Romans, February was the month of purification, like of penance and purification, to start to get ready for the new year.
Was in that March. Candlemas?
Well, now it's Candlemas, all that stuff. But in the old days, until 1970 or something, it was called the Feast of the Purification of Mary. And for the Romans, the month of February was the month of purification. It had nothing to do with Mary. Well, you know, we're still living with all this stuff. No one knows anything. And they even ask, why March? Because this is from the god Mars. Because the father of Romulus and Remus, the twins, you know, the father is Mars. And that's why they started their whole year with March in honor of the father of Romulus and Remus. We're still living with all this stuff, you know.
And this time, our thanks go to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who's currently teaching in the United States, but who spent most of his life, as I mentioned a moment ago, as papal Latinist, serving under many popes. And that's all I have time for today. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back again at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to join me then. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. And you've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.